case is MacIver versus the Portsmouth Department of Social Services. Are there anyone you can say about that?
Good morning. I'm Diane Ringer on behalf of the appellant in this case. This is, of course, an appeal with right for Ms. MacIver. And, excuse me, I'm just staring. I guess that's my timer. And I'm not reserving any time for rebuttal.
Very well.
These are always such awful cases, and I need to try to resist the urge to tug on the court's heartstrings. That's not what we're here for. I tried that below. It certainly didn't work. I wish it would.
That the trial court had no authority under either 283B or C, I gather. Is that correct?
Right. Well, not a question of authority, Your Honor. I mean, the issue here and the standard we're looking at, and I'm going to try to articulate this. What this court has to consider on a sufficiency argument is, was the trial court's judgment plainly wrong or without evidence to support it?
Yeah.
That's always a very difficult standard, but I'm the appellant standing here, obviously. In my brief, I've made separate and distinct arguments. Of course, the city social services proceeded under the two prongs of the termination statute, which they can do. And the trial judge terminated as to both, found sufficient evidence under the clear and convincing standard.
But my question was, if we find the evidence suffices under either, we defer, right?
I'm sorry, I missed a part.
If we find the evidence sufficient under either 283B or C,
yes,
we defer.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And you may very well, the court may very well say, well, we affirm under B, therefore we're not going to address C. But yes, either or both, yes, sir. As I said, I've made separate arguments as to each, and if the court has specific questions, I'll certainly address those. But what I would like to do in the few minutes I have, under both prompts, under B and C, and again, I'm trying to frame this in the sense of the standard of review here. Was there evidence to support the trial court's findings? But the overlay, the common thread under B and C basically to me boils down to, have we fixed what was wrong? If we haven't fixed it, why haven't we fixed it? And then I think maybe the most important part, and it's worded differently under B and C, but what we look at and what the trial court looks at is, can it be fixed? Is it reasonably likely we're going to fix it? And of course, under C, we've got that 12-month thing, although we can also go beyond that and look at the evidence right up to the date of the hearing, April of this year. And of course, the overlay there of everything is what is in the best interest of the children. What strikes me on, again, trying to bear in mind the standard, is there evidence to support it? I think it's perhaps easy and it's very tempting to pick at specific pieces of evidence that were adduced during the hearing. And there were so many, certainly not in Ms. MacIver's favor. She didn't finish a psychological evaluation. I suppose if we want to, we could say, well, that's a basis that the court could terminate. She only finished, I think it was 16 out of 32 or 35, some up-center, hands-on parenting thing. She didn't complete that. There are several things. She didn't pick up her medication. She didn't follow through with things. She didn't have stable housing. I think it's easy and tempting to look at any or all of those and say, well, there it is. That's certainly a basis for the trial court to terminate. What I would argue to this court is, I don't want to sound Fourth Amendment-ish because that's not where we're at, but what I ask the court to look at is more of the whole totality.
Well, doing that, what's the likelihood that any of that would change?
Her
inability to care for the child. I think one psychologist said she can't take care of herself, much less her children. We look at her current status now. Where is the evidence that she has moved forward or is in a position to move forward in a reasonable amount of time?
There's not a whole lot of that, Judge. I'll acknowledge that. And what there is not very strong, and I suppose for the most part, it came from the testimony of Ms. MacIver. And you know, certainly the trial judge can accept or reject her testimony. We really don't know what the trial judge thought because, and I'm not trying to rag on the trial court, but the court, it might be different if the court said, you know what, it's very nice, she's up here, she's sobbing, she's boo-hooing, she's saying that now she's going to do X, Y, and Z, but I don't believe a word of it.
We do know what the trial judge thought because he terminated this on two grounds.
Yes, sir.
Specifically, what do you know?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
But what I'm trying to say is we don't know, because he did state, and I don't suppose he had to state, he didn't specifically state, I don't buy a word of it. Based on her testimony, I don't believe it. So what I asked this court to do in considering if there was evidence to support the trial judge's finding is to look at everything, including her testimony at trial, which we know by the time of trial, mid-April of this year, she had obtained some employment, not great, some kind of part-time employment with the church. She was looking at housing. She told the judge that she was ready and willing to get back to the counseling. I think she said it was the very first counselor they had referred her to.
And
the
she one, was pregnant again.
Yes, she was, but I think that's a non-factor. Certainly it's something we can say, well, golly gee, how is she going to manage that? But I'm looking to put that aside. In a perfect world, no, she wouldn't be pregnant again. In a more perfect world, she wouldn't have had these two children at apparently a very young age. I think she was 22 at the hearing. The older child was already 5, so we can do that math. But what I asked the court to look at, again, is that totality. And I think instead of just saying, well, she didn't do X, she didn't do Y, therefore it was okay, the trial court had a basis to terminate, I think you look at everything. And when you get to that question, which Judge O'Brien, I think, was pointing out or getting to, of how do we know she's going to? Well, how do we know she's going to do what she's going to do, which is, or is it reasonably likely, or is there a reasonable likelihood that she's going to correct it? Yeah, we can look at her track record up to this point, which was not great. I'm sorry. But, you know, I guess it's like, and I don't want to get all metaphysical here, but it's like, how can we ever be sure, or even reasonably sure, or reasonably likely about anything? And I'm going to conclude with this, and then if the court has questions, I'll just ask the court to consider on this whole standard of review and what was brought out of the hearing. I'm going to ask the court to consider what I unsuccessfully asked the trial judge to consider, which is the kind of the spectrum of these cases. And, you know, these are appeals of right. I know the court hears many, many of these. I know how the vast majority of these are ruled on. But as I told the trial court, we have the spectrum. At one end, we have a parent who, you know, they've done something a little bit wrong. Maybe they left the kids unsupervised overnight or something, and they get some services, they go to some parenting classes, and they're going to get their kids back. And they do get the kids back. I love those. You've got the other end of the spectrum, where the parent or parents are basically, they're total zeros. They don't visit the children in foster care. They make zero effort to go to counseling. They make zero effort to get drug treatment, whatever laundry list that social services has given them. And that usually comes out of that parenting capacity evaluation. Ms. McIver, I would submit, falls somewhere in the middle. Not totally hopeless, certainly not a slam dunk that she's going to, but when you think of all that, again, all I can ask this court to consider is, could, based on everything at the hearing, could the trial judge make that determination that there's basically just no way she's ever going to do what needs to be done so that these children can safely be returned to her?
If she's somewhere in the middle of the spectrum.
Yes, sir.
But by the way, does not that, by definition, subsume that there is sufficient evidence to support the judge's decision?
I don't think so, and I'm not trying to play semantic games or metaphysical games. I guess my concept of the concept that it's not there's no reasonable or substantial likelihood, to me, that's the person who's pretty much at, where was I, at this total zero end. Again, she had things going for her. She had a lot against her, but she had her strengths. She had her limitations. Yeah, if the court had in the, I think it's in volume two, the sealed volume in the appendix, yeah, she had a horrible childhood, the whole nine yards. She was doing what she was doing, and I don't think we were at that point, and I think the court, the trial court, did not have enough evidence to, in effect, basically pull the plug and say, we're not going to try to reunify this family anymore. It's time to pull the plug. It's time to move on. The last point I would just make, and I guess this really doesn't specifically address the sufficiency of the standard and so forth, but the city in its brief did point out, and it's certainly true based on the case law, the whole concept that, you know, we don't want to let children languish in foster care, we don't want them to go through the anxiety of not knowing and so on and so forth. And that certainly is that's the law, that's certainly a factor that the trial judge can consider, and I'm sure he did in this case. What I would just respectfully point out, and there's really no evidence either way, but I think we can assume, you know, these are very young children. The older boy, or the boy, is I think 5 at the time of hearing, the little girl is 3. I think it's safe for us to figure that these younglings have no concept that mommy has a foster care review hearing in a month or that mommy is still trying to have services. Were they older, certainly they would, certainly there'd be that anxiety, and I think then we could more say, you know, we need to give these kids some finality. They need to know, are they going to go home or are they going to be put up for adoption? I just don't think that's as big a factor in this case. For those reasons, I asked the court, and of course we have 4 judgments. We have the 2 foster care plans that kind of go hand in hand with the termination, and I would ask this court to consider everything and reverse the circuit court judgment. Unlike in a criminal case, I don't think termination is it's not like double jeopardy. If this court were to reverse, given this very high standard I'm up against, but if this court were to reverse, to my way of thinking, if Ms. McIver doesn't do what she has to do or continues not doing or whatever, they can bring it back. There's nothing to stop them from saying, okay, you know what? You got lucky on appeal, you got another bite at the apple, you're still not doing it. Now we've got even more argument that we're going to make to terminate your rights. So that would be my position this morning. And I thank you all for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Ringer. I should have asked this before. I assume that the guardian ad litem and the social services have worked out and agreed to use of the 15 minutes time?
Yes, that's okay with Your Honor.
Absolutely, whatever. And I know the guardian ad litem does not always appear here. We think they should. We are thrilled that you're here. Thank you. But we're ready to hear from you, sir.
Thank you, Your
Honor. And I gather we're here to agree that the guardian ad litem supports the trial court's decision.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, may it please the court, I'm a Burl Strumper, Assistant City Attorney for the City of Portsmouth, and I represent the Portsmouth Department of Social Services today. As you all are probably well aware, the standard of review on appeal for the Logan case, especially the good case, states, number one, first, the evidence should be viewed in the light most favorable to the prevailing party at the trial level, which was the Portsmouth Department of Social Services. Second, the trial court is presumed to have made its decision in the child's best interest after thoroughly investigating and weighing the evidence. And third, the judgment of the trial court will not be disturbed on appeal unless plainly wrong or without evidence to support it. In the case before you, the trial court found the evidence to be clear and convincing to terminate the parental rights of Ms. McIver. The children were, as you heard, 5 and 3 years of age at the time. By implication, the court accepted the goal of adoption in the foster care service plan, since that's a lower standard by preponderance of the evidence rather than clear and convincing. The trial court based its decision to terminate parental rights on 2 different paragraphs of 16.1 and 283. The Code of Virginia, the first was paragraph B, as the justices have mentioned. That requires determination to be in the best interest of the child and that the neglect or abuse suffered by the child presented a serious and substantial threat to his life, health, and development. And number 2, the second prong, is that it's not reasonably likely that the conditions which resulted in such neglect or abuse can be substantially corrected or eliminated so as to allow the child's return. That category two, that paragraph two, has a subsection C to it. It gets darn confusing when you read this after a while. But that provides that a parent who has not followed through with rehabilitative efforts offered by social services constitutes prima facie evidence that the conditions cannot be corrected. And that's what the evidence did show at trial, unfortunately. Look, I don't like doing these. I work with these folks all the time. We're in court, in J&D court all the time. And it's not pleasant to terminate parental rights, but we've got to do what's in the best interest of the child, and we have to follow the law. The evidence showed that in June of 2013, the mother was living in a shelter with her two children. At that time, they were ages 1 and 3. The three-year-old's a very difficult child, as you may have seen. Later was diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, since suspended from kindergarten even for 5 times already. So he's a difficult child. The mother attempted suicide at that shelter in front of the children, and as a result, she was hospitalized and ultimately kicked out of the shelter. She'd also been kicked out of it or discharged from another shelter earlier for physically reprimanding one of the children against the policy of that shelter. So it sort of goes to show, even then, there was a lack of stable housing, which is consistent throughout this whole case. She moved, somebody haven't shown, 6 or 7 times, and never, and even at the circuit court hearing, she was living with a boyfriend, she had become pregnant, and the police had responded several times to that house for domestic, or at least arguments, if not fighting. There were no acceptable relatives to take the children. We always looked for that first. But they were placed with a family friend for a while. That only lasted 2 weeks, probably because of the, at the time, three-year-old's behavior, I assume. But they were returned. And at that point, Portsmouth Department of Social Services really had no other choice but to take them into custody. And interestingly, a year earlier, it was called an ongoing service file was opened, and that's before foster care, because Ms. McIver was found to be drinking alcohol and smoking marijuana with a boyfriend in the house with the kids present. And so she actually started getting services a year prior. The evidence also showed that the department set up services ad nauseum. I mean, they really worked hard on this case. And she outright refused the services at points. She did, Ms. Ringer mentioned a couple things she did. She went 16 times out of 35 times for one of the parenting classes. Otherwise, she refused medical and psychological services, medication management, which was very important with her, you know, to get that medicine because of her diagnosis, which I'll touch on in a bit. She failed to go to a dual diagnosis support group. She didn't take advantage of the employment and housing services that the department offered her. And so she just outright refused. And as I mentioned, a lot of those services, and as Ms. Ringer mentioned, were based on a parenting capacity evaluation performed by a clinical psychologist, Lisa Leon, who diagnosed Ms. McIver with major depressive disorder severe with mood congruent psychotic features, recurrent post-traumatic stress disorder, which was chronic, and then even diagnosed neglect of children, listed that as a diagnosis. She further opined that there was a high risk of further child abuse and neglect. And of course, that's not in the best interest of these children to take that risk of going back to somebody who could abuse or neglect them again. And then she concluded, as Justice O'Brien mentioned, that Ms. McIver was unable to care for her own basic needs, let alone two children, and now there would be, I assume, a third child. It's, you know, I mentioned the standard, and lots of times, in a lot of these cases, the best interest of the child is forgotten. Everybody just runs to those, the two-pronged test, and there's been a recent case on that, but it's clear the best interest of the children would be not to go back to her. She wasn't taking her medicine. The diagnosis was pretty severe. The chance of further risk, or the chance of further neglect or abuse was there. And the clinical psychologist mentioned that. As a matter of fact, by October 2014, she called Portsmouth Department of Social Services and said she didn't want to reunify with the kids. And even said, don't call her anymore. And that's a very sad situation, but it is what it is. You know, we have to look out for the children. Trial court also based its ruling on 16.1-283C, which requires the parent to remedy her situation within 12 months. As stated earlier, Ms. McIver was unwilling to remedy the conditions at all, but she did have 19 months. She had 7 months extra. It wasn't heard in Jane D. court until 19 months after the kids were taken. And as I mentioned before, there was a year prior where she was getting some services. The kids were in foster care. And one of the cases that I believe I cited in my brief, the Chappelle case, states that it's not in the best interest of a child to spend a lengthy period of time to find out when a parent will be capable of resuming his or her responsibilities. And in this case, 19 months went by before J&D. Then we even went up to circuit court, a couple more months were added, where it's a de novo hearing. She could have presented more evidence she was remedying the situation. The appellant cited Roanoke versus, I believe it's Hyde or Haide, H-E-I-D-E, in her brief, that Ms. McIver changed her mind and was willing to do some of these things. But that case is somewhat distinguishable because in that case, the circuit court ruled in favor of the parent, and so all the inferences on appeal were in favor of that parent, not the Department of Social Services. And in that case, the father actually did rehabilitate himself. He was an alcoholic, and he did unbelievable things. In our case, Ms. McIver moved in with a boyfriend, although she said he was no longer a boyfriend and had someone else with her in court, the circuit court, but acknowledged that they had been fighting, acknowledged she was pregnant, and that the police had been out to that house at least a couple times to break up either arguments or fights. Certainly not in the best place for children to go when that is still going on. And so we would respectfully request that you affirm the circuit court's decision, and I will assume I have enough time for the guardian ad litem.
Yes, please. Thank you. Ms. Chang.
Just to reiterate the standard that's already been addressed, but in particular as it relates to this matter, this court is not to disrupt the trial court's ruling unless there is not sufficient evidence. There was a request at the beginning of the appellant's argument that the court look at the whole totality, and there was also language addressed about a spectrum. I will certainly concede that Ms. McIver, whom I worked with in detail, was at the far end, the positive end of the spectrum as it relates to visiting with her children and contact with her children. She's almost at the farthest end possible, but that's about it in terms of how close she is to that end of the spectrum. As it relates to the opposite end of the spectrum, that's where where her non-activity, lack of participation, at times outright refusal to participate in not just with social services, but with the other various organizations and recommendations she was supposed to follow. And also, to be frank, as in regards to her motivation, she's at the other end of the spectrum. I would point out specifically in regards to the whole totality, looking at the whole totality, as referenced before, with the psychological and the parenting evaluation that was done by Dr. Leon, some of it was briefly addressed. But looking at where she was and where she needed to be in terms of regaining an appropriate location and house and ability to care for her children, the concerns addressed by Dr. Leon were numerous, specifically that Ms. McIver was at high risk for another suicide attempt or for additional self-destructive behavior, that she was unable and to adequately care for her own basic needs, let alone the needs of her children. Additionally, what was not referenced in the appellate's brief is that there's a reference that she was at high risk for abuse again, unless and until she received certain circumstances. So again, going back to that, looking at the totality, there are, I counted at least 12 different concessions in the statement of facts in the appellate's brief, 12 different confessions. That testimony and evidence was presented. It was by the Department of Social Services representative that was there, the Miss Curry. There's at least 12 different confessions to where there were either services that were denied, or excuse me, not denied, services that were refused or incomplete. I can certainly run through them. But that in addition to the statement of facts as well, there were at least six that I read confessions by Ms. McIver herself, and in terms of testimony, her own testimony, her acknowledging. I can certainly, I will run through just those six alone. She acknowledged that she did not complete a lot of the services, and it was for personal reasons. She went on to give a description as to her justification that ends with, I'm not really sure. I believe referencing, I'm not sure why. She acknowledges that she didn't complete the Parents as Teachers program. She completed less than half of those requirements. She acknowledges that she didn't complete a psych eval. She acknowledges that she did not pick up and follow through with her prescribed medication. She said that she didn't really feel like the medication was helping her. Well, if we go back to what was required by Dr. Leon, that was based upon findings after a thorough evaluation that this medication was likely needed. She acknowledges that she had held and then lost numerous jobs due to sickness, transportation. She does go on to say, and did at the trial, that she had employment, but what was briefly addressed, but in the actual statement of fact, but was not in there in total, is that she went through a series of jobs over this period of time, and not just the 19 months, because later, of course, it was appealed up to the circuit court. So her having this new job at the church, which by itself was only part-time, was just essentially, unfortunately, a series of a new job, a new brief job. And then she then went on to concede numerous other different either services that she turned down and outright refused or just did not complete. As to the statement that was referenced about the younger children languishing in foster care may not have as much of a direct effect because they don't know the court proceedings and so forth and when is the next court hearing. My concern would be, though, is particularly as it relates to younger children, that would still be just as concerning, but maybe on a different note. And that's in the younger children languishing in foster care essentially directly affects their ability to be adopted, directly affects their ability to bond with a new potential family. And so unfortunately, it may not affect it the same age as an older child. It certainly affects it in a very significant and great way. As such, I request that that the court uphold the circuit court ruling.
Very well, thank you. Ms. Ringer, I think you may have had a minute or two left if there's anything that you want to refute.
No, sir, I think I made my argument. Thank you very much.
Very well, we'll come down and